This is Old Lady Scarms reporting for Free Radio Santa Cruz, and I'm speaking with Jeff Halper. He's the director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions in Israel and has lived in Israel for 30 years. He is in Israel this morning. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Doing pretty good. How are you?
All right, hanging in there.
Yeah. Can you give us a little background on the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and maybe a little personal background as well?
Well, I grew up, as you can hear, not in Israel. I grew up in the States, in Minnesota. But I've been here for about 30 years now. Israeli citizen, married, all that stuff. I'm a professor of anthropology. And I've been involved in the Israeli peace movement for many years. But in the last 6 or 7 years, a number of us from different Israeli peace and human rights groups have really been working on the ground to resist the occupation out of a feeling that while all our political movements are very good, there has to be more active Israeli presence on the ground together with Palestinians actually resisting the occupation. And one of the most painful and tragic and politically important issues for Palestinians is the issue of house demolitions. Since 1967, Israel's demolished more than 9,000 Palestinian homes, which is a human catastrophe of major proportions anywhere in the world, but done systematically according to policy. And it isn't only a policy intended to confine Palestinians to little islands of the occupied territories and inside Israel as well, so as to leave most of the land free for Israeli expansion and settlement, but it's also part of a 100-year-old process of displacement, of trying to get the Palestinians out of the country, of denying existentially that they have any place in this country whatsoever. So the implications of house demolitions in terms of are acknowledging that Palestinians, in fact, exist and have a right here, go far beyond the political implications also of the policy of house demolitions.
We'll talk about the house demolitions themselves, why houses are demolished, and what is done to work against that. Your organization works to rebuild Palestinian homes, among other things. But first, I'd like to ask you, there are many people who dispute that this, in fact, in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, is even an occupation. A lot of people even dispute that Palestinians even exist as a people. How would you respond to this, Jeff? You're an Israeli who's lived in Israel for 30 years.
Well, that's the way that the Israel frames the issue, and that's the way Zionism has framed the issue since the turn of the century. And that is that there aren't two sides to this conflict. There aren't Israelis and Palestinians, but there's only one people that has a legitimate claim to this whole country, the entire country, from the Jordan to the Mediterranean, and that's the Jews. That's really the way that the Zionist movement framed the whole issue, until today, really. And therefore, the country belongs exclusively to the Jewish people. And if we allow anyone else to live here, be they Palestinian or foreign workers or Christians who come here to live or whatever, we're doing so on the basis of being generous, of sufferance, not on the basis of any rights they have. So it's a very tribal way of looking at the country. It's a tribal nationalism, and it has always said there are no Palestinians. There's no Palestinian people with a discrete history, identity, culture. There is no Palestinian people that has a legitimate claim to the country. There's no Palestinian people that has a right to self-determination here. And therefore, what we have is a country owned exclusively by Jews that should be completely settled and ruled by Jews, in which we have a bunch of Arabs living. Israelis very seldom use the word Palestinians. So we have a bunch of Arabs here. I mean, that you can just look around and see. And so the whole thrust of Israeli policy all these years has been, okay, how do we control the whole country, Judaize the entire country, claim it as our own, And that's why, in a sense, it's true that there isn't an occupation. Israel doesn't use the word occupation, because what Israel says is, look, how can you occupy your own country? Therefore, we're simply administering the lands during the process of political negotiations, but in fact, these are our lands, and this is our country. Now, if the Arabs want to live here, and they shut up and behave themselves, and don't become like what we used to call uppity niggers, they don't become uppity, they don't think that they have rights here, but that they're willing to live, they know their place, very much like in the Jim Crow system. If they're willing to live like that, fine, they can stay. If they challenge our claim to the country, or if the ultimate chutzpah, if they claim the right to a country of their own here, between the Jordan and the Mediterranean, then we have every right to throw them out, to transfer them, to cleanse them, even to kill them, because they have no right to challenge our claim. And I'm putting it in a very hard way, but this is really the kernel of the issue today. For all the Israeli governments, there's no question of negotiations. I don't think Oslo was ever a real peace process. It's simply a matter of how do we ensure our control here while dealing with a lot of the Arabs that are living here. And the ideal, just the final word, the ideal framework for that is that Israel control the whole country, and that's why the settlements are being expanded, and Israel wants to turn its occupation into a permanently expanded country, and the Palestinians will be given a state within the framework of a Bantustan, like the South African Bantustan. And in that way, Israel has the whole country, but it's relieved itself of the Palestinian population.
Well, you, when you answered my question, you framed it in terms of what you feel most Israelis would respond. How do you feel? Is there an occupation? Does a Palestinian people exist? Do they have a right to a state?
No, in my view, and in the view, I think, of probably a third of the Israeli population, there is a Palestinian people. And it does have a right to exist here, and it has a right to its own self-determination. Now, the question is, what does that mean? Ideally, I would like to have a binational state here. In other words, I think there are two peoples living in this country, the Jews and the Palestinians, and I don't see any reason whatsoever why there couldn't be one country here where everybody's living together, a Western democratic model. But I know the Jews won't accept that. And also many Palestinians have reservations about that because they would like their own self-determination. So all through the years, the left in Israel, the peace movement, has favored the two-state solution. That is a Palestinian state next to the state of Israel. And that's what we've been working for. But that's getting less and less possible because of the expansion of the settlements. And the Palestinians are really in danger of simply being confined to a little Bantustan. So today, the left in Israel, the peace movement, is really in a dilemma. Because if it still pushes a two-state solution, it's liable to be advocating for a Bantustan-type solution, which isn't what we want. But a one-state solution doesn't seem to be possible at this stage. So we're kind of in a bind. What I see is a two-state solution. And that is the emergence of a viable sovereign Palestinian state next to Israel, even though it's important to understand the occupied territories only represent about 22% of the country. So it's not like a 50-50 division of the land. It's 78% Israel and 22% Palestine. As a first state, that at least gives the Palestinians a space, a political space, a cultural space, the ability to express their self-determination in a state. And then what I see happening is the emergence of a regional confederation involving Israel, Palestine, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. And I think that if we go to the model of Europe, where you disconnect residency from citizenship, and everybody, you have the different states, and they have their different parliaments, and they all have their different citizenships, but at the same time, you have freedom to live and work wherever you want to in that whole unit. I think that's a good balance between self-determination and actually allowing people to live wherever they want to live in the entire region.
Jeff, why do you believe there is a Palestinian people? What do you base that belief on?
Well, it isn't a matter of belief. The whole idea of self-determination means that a people has a right to determine itself, whether it's a people or not. I mean, I couldn't prove to you that the Jews are a nation that deserve a state either in Israel. If you look at my parents who live in Arizona, they're American. They're ethnic. They have no interest whatsoever in a Jewish state. They're very happy being Americans. You know, and they would say, no, the Jews aren't a nation. The Jews are an ethnic group. So even Jews would argue that Jews aren't a nation. So there's no way to prove these things. If the Palestinians say, we are a nation, and they develop national institutions, a national identity, and so on, and the idea of a country, then that's their right to do.
Well, there must be a history in the region that you could, you know, refer to support
right.
the fact that Palestinians have some claim as a people to this
right.
land.
Well, look, it's a problem because, you know, you don't have in the world nation states until the last 100, 150 years. You don't have countries. This world, this part of the world traditionally was empires. It was the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, the Islamic Empire, the Ottoman Empire. You didn't have discrete peoples living in countries here. So you could really make the argument that until World War I, there wasn't a Palestinian people. They were certainly Arabs living here. If anything, they were maybe Syrians, but they had a tie to the land. They worked here, they lived here, they owned land. They've been here for many generations. And just like in the United States, you know, before the 18th century, there was no American people. Every people has a genesis at some time. And whether you have your genesis 4,000 years ago or 200 years ago or 50 years ago, it really doesn't matter. The point is that you're a people rooted in the land for whatever reason, rooted in the country with a national identity. And that's what makes you a nation in the end. You don't have to prove it to anybody. You feel it yourself, and then you express it.
Well, there's a lot
of... But it's very different. The point is, it's not like the United States. You see, it's hard for Americans sometimes to get this, because in the United States, there are no nations, except for the Native Americans. But otherwise, there are no nations. All Americans are ethnic. Ethnic means that I have my cultural identity. I'm African-American. I'm a hyphenated American. African-American, Asian-American, Jewish-American, whatever. But I recognize that I'm just one group in a larger country, so I'm ethnic. But most of the world is based on national identities that are irreducible. Every national identity demands a country of its own. And that's where we are here. That's the problem with a binational state. And that is that neither the Jews, who define themselves in nationalist terms, or the Palestinians are willing simply to be ethnic groups living in a bigger country. They each want a country of their own.
Jeff, there are a lot of Jewish people and others who would argue that the Jewish people have more of a right to the land because they predate the Palestinian people, because they go further back. And then there's others who... Palestinians and people, others who support Palestinians, who would say that they go back even further,
right.
that their ancestors go back further.
Right.
What do you say to this back and forth argument?
Right. It's irrelevant, because it doesn't matter how far back you go. A national identity exists, and it doesn't matter when it was started. I mean, like I say, you know, the American people, if there's an American nation... So it comes from 1776, maybe from, 50 years before or whatever. Even at that time, during the American Revolution, there was a great argument. There were many people that said, no, we're English, we're British, we have to be loyalists, and so on. All these things have nothing to do with the time frame. They have to do with the development of a national identity in a particular country. You know, the other thing you have to keep in mind is that most Jews don't accept the idea that Jews are a nation. You know, 75% of the Jewish people never came to Israel, never identified themselves as Zionists, never accepted the fact that they were a nation. 75% of the Jewish people, at least, if not more, probably even more, see themselves as Americans, as British, as French, you know, Argentinians, wherever they come from. So that it's not necessarily even a majority that decides these sorts of things. Zionism became a viable national identity because there were enough Jews that said, yes, we're a nation, with a tie to this country to make it happen.
So why would you describe what's going on in the West Bank and Gaza Strip as an occupation? There's a lot of people, as I mentioned before, that would take issue with that.
That's right. Because I do accept the fact that there are two national groups living in this country, each of which has a legitimate national claim, and because they're national claims, they can't live in one state. And therefore, there has to be two states. And there has to be a place for a Palestinian state, for Palestinian self-determination. And the way it's worked out historically with the PLO's agreement since 1993, since Oslo, is that Palestinian state would be in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. And therefore, the fact that Israel is occupying those lands, it conquered those lands, it didn't inherit them. It conquered those lands militarily, and in that way is preventing the Palestinian people from exercising its right to self-determination. That's what makes it an occupation.
I want to talk about your work with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, Jeff Halper, but I do have a couple more questions, historical questions first. One is, I recently heard you speak, and you were saying that before 1948, there was not two sides to this conflict. Let's talk a little bit about 1948 and what you meant by that statement.
No, it's kind of what I said at the beginning of our talk tonight, today. That is that the Zionists never saw the other side. They always considered this the country that belonged to one people. And therefore, the whole process that was set in place was displacement. How do we claim this country for our own, and how, as much as possible, do we get the Arabs out? Or at least confine them to little islands? That was the case before 1948, and certainly the all the steps that were taken to drive the refugees out of the country in 1948 was a part of that policy. Certainly the steps that were taken legally to prevent their return, legally and militarily, were a part of that process of displacement. And that's what we continue to have today, is a process of displacement of the Palestinians, getting them out and, in a sense, making the whole people a refugee people in a way. So that's really what I meant by the fact that Israel only considers there to be one side to this conflict, and the other side has no rights.
Is it true that Jews and Arabs live together in peace in the region that is now Israel and the occupied territories for centuries? Together in peace, is that true?
Yeah, no, it is true. I mean, look, I don't want to idealize any situation. I mean, the Jews lived as a minority in a majority Muslim culture. But at the same time, the Jews and the Christians, who were a minority here, were definitely recognized as legitimate religious and even national groups to a certain degree. They had their right to run their own communal affairs. There was no proselytization that took place against the Jews or the Christians. They were accepted as a legitimate part of society. They were protected. In the Ottoman Empire, for example, for 400 years, the chief rabbi sat in the courtyard of the Sultan in Istanbul, together with the Greek Orthodox patriarch who was responsible for the Christians. So institutionally, And in terms of being recognized, Jews certainly had a much more secure place in the Middle East, in the Muslim world, than Jews ever had in Europe. You know, the Muslims never accused the Jews of being Christ killers, of being poisoners of wells, of being aliens. You had no anti-Semitism in the Muslim world. Jews weren't considered strangers. You know, Jews were considered in the Muslim world a part of the landscape. Communities that had been living here for many years, that had a right to live here, that were institutionally recognized. And from that point of view, you could really say, I mean, look, there were always incidences. There's always problems and tensions between minorities and majorities. But overall, you could really say that the Jews lived in the Muslim world not only in peace, but flourished in the Muslim world for all those centuries.
Now, where does the feeling and idea come from then that all Arabs want to force the Jews into the sea? Recent history?
In other words, you know, it's very convenient to cast yourself as a victim. Because victims, you know, the world owes something to the victims. We've been persecuted, us Jews, and we had everything up to the Holocaust, and therefore the world owes us a state. It owes us support. It owes us money, all this kind of stuff. And at the same time, a victim has no responsibility or no accountability because you are the victim. So that the history of persecution is really a European history. And the European Jews, I think, on the one hand, really felt the persecution and felt a need for a state. I mean, there was a genuineness to that. But at the same time, they used very much their victimhood in order to get political support for their cause. So when all of a sudden you look at the Jews that live in the Muslim world, and they didn't have that history of victimhood and persecution, it kind of created a certain hole in your PR. I mean, how can you say we're a persecuted people, that the world, we have to have a state because we don't belong anywhere in the world, when here a good part of your people have been living at peace in the Muslim world for all these years? So there was an attempt to foist on the Jews that lived in Muslim countries the European persecution story and make the Arabs and make the Muslims into persecutors of Jews just like the Europeans. You know, so the Mufti of Jerusalem becomes just like Hitler, you see. And that's a political ploy. It has nothing to do with the history, with the actual history, and it's a very cynical way of looking at Jewish history because it simply is used to support your own position and to silence critics. But it was not the history of Jews that came from Arab or Muslim countries.
Well, there are those who would say that the Arab nations would drive the Jews into the sea to take over what is now Israel. There are people who really believe that the Arab nations that surround Israel would like to wipe it off the map. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, we believe all kinds. We made up stories, and we believe them, without really going back and looking at history. I mean, one book I would recommend to everyone that really is interested in that issue is a new book called The Iron Wall by an Israeli historian named Avi Shlaim, S-H-L-A-I-M, that really gets into the story, and it's much more complex and nuanced than that kind of a line. And what you find out, for example, is that there were many chances that Israel had to make peace with the Arab states all through the years, even before the state of Israel was founded. But, and in this way, Ben-Gurion is kind of the villain, in a sense. Ben-Gurion and the leaders of the Zionist movement had a principle that I think is still the principle of saying that first, that we can always get peace with the Arab world because we're going to be the strongest unit here. That's not the problem. So what we have to do is we have to secure everything we want to in this country. We have to get everything we want to get, all the land, everything that we want, we have to get first, even if it's in conflict. And once we get it, then we'll agree to peace with the Arabs, and they'll agree to peace with us on any terms. That's the basic assumption. Israel assumes today that it can pursue the occupation, it can find the Palestinians to Bantustans, and once that happens, then the Saudi Arabians and the other Arab countries are going to come and sue for peace with Israel. So why do it now? Why not wait till we get more land and more power and then sue for peace? And that was always the idea, so that when Nasser came to Ben-Gurion and offered peace in the early 50s, when Sadat came to Golda Meir and offered to talk peace in the 70s, you know, all the way through when there were all kinds of overtures towards Israel, the Israelis rejected them because Israel believed that it hadn't yet consolidated its hold on this country the way it wanted to, and it was still too early to sue for peace with Arabs. And we didn't have to because we could always be, you see. And that's where, so the whole thing gets turned around in a way. The Arabs are blamed for wanting to drive the Jews into the sea, where in fact, I mean, look, you had figures like that as well, but overall the Arab world has been very accepting of Israel, actually.
What about 1948? And, I mean, didn't the Arabs reject the partition plan and attack Israel?
There's been a lot of historians here that look at it in a different way, that Israel accepted the partition plan because it knew that it could grow the country later on. It was a tactical move. It wasn't really an acceptance of a Palestinian state, on the one hand.
Well, how do you know?
You also have to understand that Israel was an ally with Jordan. Israel was allied with Jordan, and there were long discussions and agreements between Golda Meir and King Abdullah and so on. So that, in a way, the Arab countries invading what was then Israel, in a sense, and this is the way Avi Shlaim and other Israeli historians look at it today, was in many ways a check to the Jordanians rather than attacking Israel per se. That they were afraid that Jordan was going to come in and dominate this whole region as well. But in many ways, the 1948 war was a collusion, was an agreement between Israel and Jordan to divide the country between them and to keep the other Arab countries out. If anything, you could make the case that the Arab countries were against the Palestinians, because they invaded not necessarily to destroy Israel, but they invaded to take over areas that had been given to Palestinians by the UN. So, the whole history is much more complex than all these simple slogans that we always throw out all the time.
Now, Jeff, the Israelis were given in the partition, the UN partition plan, they were given, what was it,
56% of the country.
56% of the country?
Even though they were only a third of the population, owning only 6% of the land.
Now, once they were given 56% and they were ready to declare their independence as the nation of Israel, and they did, it was the very next day that what Arab countries attacked, and did they try to take the area that was Israel? What Arab nations attacked, and were they after the nation of Israel? Were they?
Well, you had five Arab nations attacking. You had Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq attacking. And you can look at it in different ways. You know, it was so disorganized, their attack, and so half-hearted, that there really is a question of whether there was ever an intention of really conquering Israel. Or whether or not, like I'm indicating, that they each wanted to try to claim certain pieces. You know, the Syria wanted to claim more of the Golan Heights. Jordan certainly wanted the West Bank, a little bit larger West Bank than exists today. Egypt did take Gaza and wanted Gaza and maybe more of the Negev and so on. So that the question is, was it an attack against Israel or was it an attack of these Arab countries to chop off pieces, especially that have been given to Palestinians, actually, in the other 44%, that then they could annex into their own countries. But in fact, you know, the attacks on Israel were very half-hearted. And you know, it brings up the question, what really were the motives of the Arab countries when they invaded? There was an invasion, that's true. And in the war, finally, you know, Israel took not only the 56%, but it conquered another 22%. In other words, half the land that had been partitioned to the Palestinians, Israel also conquered. Now, we always hear about Barak's generous offer, but we never hear about the Palestinians' generous offer. And that was in 1993 in Oslo, when they agreed to recognize Israel within the 1967 borders. They said to Israel, look, take the 56% and take the 22%, more than the UN gave you. Take it all. We recognize Israel in the 67 borders. We give you 78% of the country. All we want is the 22% that remains, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. Now, that's a pretty generous offer of saying we accept that we lost in the war, we accept the partition, we accept that 80% of the country we're giving up to you, we want the other 20-22%. But that wasn't enough for Israel. So, you know, the question is also the other way around. Also, the question is, and Ben-Gurion writes about this, well, were Israel's intentions really to accept partition, or was it to expand out and eventually take over the entire country?
Now, why do you believe that their intention was to expand out and take over the entire country? Is there writings of Ben-Gurion that support that idea? Is there other people, other Zionists and other leaders that wrote to this effect or spoke to this?
Yeah, the country was always seen as one country, at least from the Jordan to the Mediterranean by the Zionist movement. It was never considered two places or anything like that. And the idea of partition first arose in 1937 when the British sent what was called the Peel Commission. And then that brought up a whole debate within the Zionist movement about partition. And already in 1937, Ben-Gurion was saying, we're against partition because we claim the entire country, but we can live with partition because we know we're going to be the strong power here. And whether or not by agreement or not by agreement, we know that we're going to take over the entire country. And the word transfer, you know, already in 1911, the Zionist movement, Rupin of the Palestine Office of the World Zionist Organization, prepared a plan of transfer. Transfer was an integral part of Israeli or Zionist policy all the way through. And in 1937, Ben-Gurion said we can accept partition because we can always grow the country, and either through agreement or through military force, we can transfer the Arabs out of the country. That was always a part of the plan. So that partition wasn't like we kind of say, you think, you know, that we accepted partition because we recognize that the Palestinian people and really recognize that they can have half the country. That wasn't the case. Partition was accepted as a tactical move. But the idea was always that at one stage or another, sooner or later, this entire country is going to be ours. And that's in a million places in Ben-Gurion's writings and in the writings of other Zionist leaders.
So let's talk a little bit about 1967. There was another war. At this point, Israel controlled 78% of Palestine. They had gotten the 56% from the partition and then conquered an additional 22%, which left 22% West Bank and Gaza, right?
That's right.
And they occupy that militarily in 1967, correct? And they also
they also
annexed parts of East Jerusalem in that.
Right. And the Golan Heights.
Can you talk about that a little bit? The 67 borders is what people often argue that the Israelis should return to create a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. So why should they return to the 67 borders? And just can you just address that particular war briefly?
Well, even if, well, the 67 war, you know, again, you know, you have the problem between immediate causes and more long-range causes. I don't believe, personally, that Israel had to get to the 67 war. I think it could have gotten to peace with the Arab states. You know what? In 1948, 49, 50, I think Israel could have made peace with the Arab states. But
Why do you believe that, Jeff?
Because on the basis of the Rhodes agreements, on the basis of Nasser coming to power and making overtures and trying to make connections to Ben-Gurion, on the basis of always close working relations between Israel and Jordan. Israel and Jordan have been allies de facto for 50-some years already. On the basis of all of those sorts of things, I think you could really make a case that Israel could have had peace much earlier than that. So the question then is, well, then why do we get to the 67 war? And I think one of the answers has to be, I mean, I don't want to let the Arabs off the hook altogether. I mean, certainly they were Arab countries that that had grievances against Israel. I don't think the idea was in 67 to destroy Israel, but it was certainly to try to realign this part of the world and give Palestinians some of their rights and to kind of put Israel in its place a little bit. But what happened was, but you know, in other words, 67 happened, in my view, because Israel did not address the needs of either the Palestinians or the Arab countries around. It saw itself always as a foreign entity here. It allied itself with the colonial powers. Look, it went in 56. Israel went to war against Egypt together with England and France.
Well, Israel
invaded Egypt.
In 56, yeah.
In 1956, together with England and France. Well, why in the hell would you do something like that if in the end you're trying to integrate into the region, if you don't want expansion? And I'm saying that the agenda of expanding and taking over the entire country was always the key basis to Zionist policy. And the idea of making peace with the Arab world was something that could always wait and wait and wait. And it invited all kinds of wars. And the Arabs tried in different ways to address that situation of Israel's expansion and of Israel's alliance with the colonial powers. Until today. You know, if you look at the AIPAC website, don't believe me, believe the Israelis. I invite all your listeners to open the AIPAC website, which is the Israeli Lobby in Washington, AIPAC.org, and go to Strategic Relationships, and you'll see that Israel, it says it up front, we are helping the United States to control the Middle East. We're a part of Bush's theater defense. We're helping the United States control the Middle East militarily. We're protecting America's economic interests here. We're helping in the war against terrorism. Israel today is an agent and a willing agent of the United States. And Israel says so. It isn't some conspiracy theory of mine. Israel always, always put itself on the side of the colonial powers against the Arabs rather than trying to live with the Arabs. And that invited wars. And in those wars, Israel was attacked sometimes. In 1967, Israel was attacked. But it was attacked because it didn't deal with the issues of coexistence here, of regional integration, of dealing with the Palestinians the way it should have dealt with them.
Well, was it attacked? I mean, my understanding is that Israel destroyed the first day of the 67 war. Israel went into Egypt and destroyed their entire air force. So, I mean, who fired the first shots? Israel, correct? That's what I hear.
Yeah, well, it was a preemptive strike. So you could ask the question, was it necessary? Maybe it was necessary at that time in that immediate context. I guess what I'm trying to say overall is that Israel really bears, in my view, the lion's share of responsibility for the mess we have today, because it never wanted to integrate in the Arab world into the region. It never recognizes Palestinians. It always wanted to expand its territory. It always behaved very aggressively with its neighbors. It allied its force itself with the enemies, the colonial enemies of its neighbors, and Israel is a very strong state. You know, I guess the big problem I have with all the slogans that you've been, and I know you've been saying these because this is what everybody says, about Israel being attacked, and Israel, all that stuff, all lets Israel off the hook. You see, that somehow Israel is the victim. Again, that same thing. Israel is the fifth largest nuclear power in the world. It has an army, an air force, a navy, among the best in the world. You know, Israel is now training the Chinese and Indian armies and equipping them with arms. It's not this little tiny nerdy Jewish boy in a bully kind of a neighborhood. And so what we have is a situation where all these slogans that you've been bringing up let Israel off the hook and present Israel as the little victim to Arab aggressors, and it completely turns around the whole situation where, in fact, this little Israel has really been the aggressor all this time, and especially it bears responsibility because Israel could have made peace with the Arabs, I think, decades ago.
I'm speaking.
But it didn't do it willingly because it wants to control the entire country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's until today.
You're tuned to 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz, and I'm speaking with Jeff Halper. He is of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and has lived in Israel for 30 years. And, Jeff, how do you think Israel could have conducted itself differently? You're criticizing your country's conduct in the past and currently. How do you feel they could have, that Israelis, the Israeli leadership, could have behaved differently and could behave differently in order to have peaceful relations with its neighbors?
It's no different today. Today is simply the continuation of the past. There's been no change whatsoever in Israeli policy for the last 70, 80 years from before there was an Israel. And the answer, and today they have the same opportunities. The Palestinians want to make peace with Israel. The Arab world, look at the Saudi plan. The Arab world wants to make peace with Israel. Why is Israel pursuing its settlement? Why is it pursuing the consolidation of its occupation? Why is it so aggressively attacking civilian Palestinians? You know, why is it still in league with the United States against the other countries in the Middle East? You see, it's still on a collision course with its neighbors. And the answer is because, again, it sees itself not as a part of the Middle East. It's almost, you know what, I think about this sometimes. It's almost autistic. It's almost like a very strong actor, person, I don't know, with a lot of muscles, that's able really in a crowd of other kids to exert his power, but he's autistic. And he doesn't see that he's alienating other kids. He's pushing them around, but he doesn't get it. You see, he doesn't understand that in the end he's got to make friends. In the end he's got to kind of listen when he hurts people. When somebody says, ouch, you stop, you see. But when, I don't want to say anything against autistic people. That's not my intention. But what I'm trying to say here is that there's a blindness to its context. Israel is just blindly going out, and it thinks it can beat everybody. It has a win-lose mentality. And at some point, I don't think it's going to win. At some point, Israel could certainly lose. But what I said in my lecture, what I write about, is the fact that Israel at some point either is going to get into a win-win mode of thought, meaning that we have to accommodate ourselves to the Arab world around us, or I think it's just going to become a rogue state, you see. It has to accept responsibility, and when it accepts responsibility, and when it says, okay, we want to integrate into our region, I think the region will be willing to have it.
Now, don't...
But Israel hasn't reached that point yet at all. Israel, look at, I mean, the Saudi Arabians said, we'll make peace with you. And all the Arab countries said you could integrate into the region if you get rid of your occupation. You know what? I would have expected dancing in the streets of Tel Aviv. We won. We have a strong Israel. and everything else, and the Arab world's accepting us in peace and integration. We won. It's over. And what did Israel do? It completely ignored the Saudi proposal. I mean, because it had no interest whatsoever in making a real peace with its Arab neighbors. And the next time there's a war, then Israel will blame the Arabs for attacking it again. You see the twisted kind of a situation we're in.
Well, don't the Palestinians also have some responsibility in this? I mean, for example, in Camp David at 2000, the year 2000, there was a very generous offer by Barak to the Palestinians, and they turned it down. Arafat turned it down, and he didn't offer a counter offer and just walked away from the table.
Right. But there was no generous offer. That's a complete myth. First of all, there was a counter offer. And that was, you get out of the 22% of our country. What else can we counter-offer? That we keep 20%, that we keep 15%, that we keep 10%? What else can we counter? We gave you 78% of the country. That's it. I mean, how much more can we counter-offer? And what does a generous proposal mean? A generous proposal should be saying, okay, take the 22%. But to say then that, well, we'll give you 95% or we'll give you 85% of a little tiny speck of land for your country, you see, it isn't generous. It would lock the Palestinians into a Bantustan. Barak's so-called generous proposal meant that Israel keeps the entire central part of the West Bank, which is Greater Jerusalem. The Palestinians are kept away from Jerusalem, which besides its religious and cultural significance, more than half the Palestinian economy revolves around Jerusalem. Israel would keep control of its settlements. Israel would keep control of the borders. Israel would keep control of the water, the airspace. So, you know, and then give up 90%, and they could still give up 90% of the land and still keep complete control of the country and confine Palestinians to islands.
Are you saying that they wouldn't have had a sovereign nation because Israel would have controlled the airspace,
right,
the water, the borders, etc.?
They would have had islands. Well, they would have had a few small disconnected islands without water, without communications, without freedom of movement, without sovereignty, without economic viability, had they accepted Barak's offer.
Why didn't Arafat offer?
Even the words we use. Just think of the word generous offer. That's a very one-way term. It's like we're offering. We have the right to offer. All you have the right to do is react. You see? It isn't a real discussion. And the Palestinians said, no, that generous offer is not generous. And look, and they paid the price for it.
Now, why didn't Arafat offer a counteroffer?
There isn't any counteroffer. The only thing he could, even the 22% isn't a viable state. The 22% of the country is an area the size of Delaware. So try to have a country where you've got 4 million people, you've got 4 million refugees that you have to deal with. You have to try to develop an infrastructure, develop an economy, become a sovereign state, in a country the size of Delaware. I mean, what else could he? How else could he counter propose it? We'll take a country the size of Rhode Island. I mean, where there was no more margin. They were down to the bare bone already. The Palestinians. Even the 22%, I don't think is viable.
Well, did he walk away from the table or not?
No, he didn't walk away from the table. Barak simply said, "Take it or leave it." There was no more table. There was no table. A table means there's negotiation. The minute somebody says to me, okay, I don't recognize you, you have no say in this, you do what I tell you, and this is take it or leave it. You either take what I say or forget it all. There's no more table to walk away from. You know, Israel presented those conditions to Palestinians that they had not only to accept Israel, but they also had to accept 80% of the settlers. And Israeli Jerusalem and control of water and everything else, and they said that, and that's not negotiating. That's what you're going to get, period. Now either you take it or leave it. So they left it.
Well, you often hear
Israel bears a responsibility in that. I think more so than the Palestinians, because the Palestinians were trying to negotiate something real, and Israel never, ever, ever intended that a real Palestinian state would emerge. Never. Not in the brightest days of Oslo. And during the 7 years of Oslo, at the same time that Israel is negotiating peace, it's doubling its settler population. So what is that? I mean, you're creating facts on the ground that absolutely prejudice the negotiation.
Well, you often...
There's no good faith here. And in that situation, there's no table. There's no real negotiation. It's simply a bunch of dictates.
You often hear on the other side, if there is two sides, which I believe there's far more than that, but you often hear that, well, Arafat did not walk away from the table. He continued to negotiate with Barak up until Taba, and then it was actually Barak who ended negotiations. Is that true?
Well, that's true as well. I mean, Barak said in the Haaretz newspaper, our main newspaper, about a month ago, that there weren't any Taba negotiations. Barak said he refused to send a delegation. There were no negotiations. It was simply a discussion. Barak basically left the discussion, left the negotiations after Camp David, and he said to the Palestinians, "You take or leave our offer, which was basically 85% of the West Bank and Gaza, but leaving most of the settlements and Israeli control intact." That's what Barak offered the Palestinians. Nothing they could accept. And he really walked away from the negotiations. But even before that, you know, there's something else. Arafat, you see, what Barak did, you know, Oslo was based on the idea of stages. There'd be stages because the Palestinians started with nothing. The idea is there'll be three Israeli withdrawals between 1993 and 1999. And by May of 1999, the Palestinians will have control of all the West Bank and Gaza except for the settlements and the military facilities, and those will be negotiated. And there would be a parity, and there would be trust between the two sides. But Israel never withdrew. It never withdrew. It only withdrew from 18% of the West Bank in the end. It doubled its settler population. It built a massive bypass road system to incorporate the West Bank into Israel proper. And so in the end, what happened was that the whole thing fell apart because Barak then said, okay, forget the stages. Israel never withdrew. Palestinians are left with these little tiny islands, 200 disconnected islands. So Barak says, okay, let's jump to the final status. Let's go to Camp David and resolve the whole thing. And the Palestinians, and Arafat in particular, I remember this, said, no, we can't do this. There's no parity yet. We have nothing. We've got Area A, which is 18% of the West Bank. You have everything. You've doubled your settlement population. There's no basis for negotiation. And it's going to fail. Arafat said, Camp David will fail, and I'm going to get blamed for it. And Barak pushed Clinton. Even Albright was against Camp David. Barak pushed Clinton, they had Camp David, the whole thing fell apart because it couldn't have succeeded. And then they blamed Arafat, exactly the way he predicted it would happen. Because there was no good faith. Israel was not going to give the Palestinians a viable state, period.
So Jeff, I'm speaking, by the way, with Jeff Halper of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Let's talk about what's happening now. Let's just conclude with a few final questions. What's happening now? The occupation, as you said in your talk the other night, is becoming permanent. Israel is creating what you call facts on the ground. What do you mean by that? And what do you mean by Bantustan? You often refer to that as well.
Right. Well, the fact that, you know, Israel's policy has always been one, like I've said, of expansion and of claiming the entire country. That's the bottom line that you have to just understand. Israel will not allow a viable, sovereign Palestinian state to emerge. It won't do it. It'll keep control of the whole country. Now, a Bantustan comes out of the Bantustan comes out of South Africa, out of apartheid. When the white South Africans had the same problem, how do we keep control of the whole country but get rid of the black Africans? So they set up 10 Bantustans, what they called homelands, in which they would confine the black African population. The black African population was, I think, 89% or something of the population, and it was confined to about 10 or 11 or 12% of the land, you see. So it's the same idea. It's confining the Palestinians to islands, calling those islands a state, a Bantustan state. Then we're rid of that Palestinian population. We're not responsible for them, and we can go on and annex the rest of the land. And that's really where the occupation is going. Creating facts on the ground is Sharon's strategy, in which Sharon has always said, from 1977, when he began this whole settlement project, in 77, as a minister in Begin's government, Sharon said, look, there'll be vagaries in the peace process. There'll be ups and downs. There'll be a peace-oriented Israeli government and a more conservative one. There'll be different American administrations. Geopolitics will change. We have to create a situation in which our control of the West Bank is absolute, is immune from any of the vagaries of geopolitics. And therefore, we have to create facts on the ground that are so massive and so permanent, settlements, cities, roads, and military controls that are so permanent that they can never, never be rolled back, you see. And in that way, then our control of the West Bank is not dependent on negotiations. We've created facts. That's it. It's over. And where we are today is just at that line, I think. We might even have passed it, where it's a done deal. There is no more occupation because we've moved to a permanent apartheid.
Is it true?
Israel has made its occupation permanent. The Palestinians will always be an island, and it's over.
Is it true, Jeff, that the Israeli government is talking about stripping Arab Israelis of their citizenship and of transferring them, along with Palestinians living under occupation in the West Bank and Gaza, out into Jordan or some other Arab nation?
That's right, because the problem is that no people will accept a Bantustan. I mean, who's going to live in a... What people is willing to confine itself to a prison? The South African blacks weren't, and neither are the Palestinians. And so one way that Israel has then to deal with the Palestinians is to say, okay, we'll ship you out of the country. And it's not only, and this is an important point, it's not only the Palestinians of the occupied territories, but Palestinian citizens of Israel that Israel has never recognized as equal citizens. And so now there's a move on the part of the Minister of Interior to strip citizens of Israel who are Palestinians of their citizenship if they prove to be disloyal to the state. I think there's about 10 or 11 Palestinian members of parliament in Israel. They almost all have files and charges against them, and their parties are being outlawed. There's a whole attempt to transfer, in many ways, I think, the population of inside Israel, the Palestinian population, out as well. This isn't only a situation of occupation, and it simply shows that until today, Israel has not reconciled itself with the fact that there's another people living here.
Now, let's talk about your work with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. You mentioned at the beginning of the interview that 9,000 Palestinian homes, or over 9,000 homes, have been demolished by the Israeli government since 1967. Why are these homes demolished? And, you know, we'll talk about your work against that.
Well, the homes are demolished in all kinds of ways, some through military strikes, some through because Israel wants to clear land, like in 67, some for by court orders. They're all being done in order, again, to displace the Palestinians. The message is there's no place for you in this country. Because we have to remember that the vast majority of inhabitants of the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem are refugees. They're Palestinian refugees from 1948. So if you say to a refugee, you can't come home, because your house has been demolished, it's been destroyed inside Israel. But we won't let you find another refuge where you are. We're going to demolish your house where you are. What's the message? The message is there is no place for you whatsoever in this country. And therefore, house demolitions, in our view, is the essence of the conflict. It really gets to the very core of the fact that Israel does not want Palestinians in this country, period. And that's what that's why house demolitions is such an important issue to pursue.
Now, how do you pursue that issue?
All right. Well, we resist. It isn't only protest; it's resistance to house demolitions and the occupation that we do together with Palestinians. When we know that the houses are going to be demolished, we try to go out and get in front of the bulldozers and try to stop the demolitions. We get arrested sometimes, but as Israelis, we're not really in danger. Palestinians would get shot for doing what we do. But because we're Jewish and Israeli, they don't really do too much to us. And when houses are demolished, we rebuild demolished houses. That's why I was in the States trying to raise money to build houses that have been demolished, because that, again, is our way of resisting not only the policy of demolition, but resisting the entire idea that Palestinians have no place in this country.
Now, I understand that at the same time that Palestinian homes are demolished to make way for bypass roads that are only for Jewish people to travel on that connect the settlements, and are demolished to make way for settlements, to build Jewish settlements that only Jews can live in. Oftentimes, these lands have been in Palestinian families for hundreds of years, correct? Okay, now, at the same time, there's no limits on Jewish immigration, is my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, or on building permits for Jewish people, but at the same time, Palestinians find it very difficult to obtain a building permit, even to put up, say, a chicken coop. Am I correct in this?
That's right. And the whole, but again, the whole principle here, and it's very different. It's very hard for Americans to accept this. The whole principle is one that this country belongs to one people, and therefore we have more rights than anybody else. You see. In other words, in the United States, if you would say Santa Cruz should be 70% white, and all the other ethnic groups should find, you know, little places, and then we're only going to let them live in little corners, and we're going to demolish their houses if they get close to white areas, all that would be unacceptable. It's racism. It's discrimination. It's simply you couldn't. It goes against all the principles of democracy, equality, and so on. Here, those principles are acceptable. We use the word in Israel, Judaization. We Judaized the country. We Judaized Jerusalem. The policy of Israel is to maintain a 72% majority of Jews over Arabs in Jerusalem through house demolitions, through transfers, through all kinds of ways, you see. And if you say to an Israeli, but wait, these are racist policies. It's racist to allow Jews to have the houses and not Palestinians. It's racist to allow Jews to move into the country any way they want to, but Palestinians can't. Israelis would say, no, that's not racism. We're making our country Jewish. That's what we're supposed to be doing. That's the point of Zionism.
What's wrong with that, Jeff? What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that?
Yeah.
That's the question Israelis would have.
I'm asking you, Jeff, what is wrong with that, with Israelis saying that we're just making our country Jewish?
Because if the Jews were the only people here, this had really been a barren land with nobody else, I wouldn't have any problem with that. But that's not the case. You've got here in the country 4.5 million. I mean, in this country, you know, there's only, if you take the whole country together, there's 5.5 million Jews and 4.5 million Palestinians. So, you know, it's almost 50-50. You know, well, you can't have one group that says, well, this is our country, And we have more rights than you do. You're all out. I mean, it's the same thing that isn't right in any situation. It's oppression. It's denying rights to other people. So you can't Judaize a country that happens to have non-Jews living in it without being racist and without being oppressive. Mm. And that's our problem.
Now, Jeff, you work directly with Palestinians and have for how long?
For how long have you done this?
The house demolition issue we've worked on for the last 6-7 years.
So how is it working alongside Palestinians? Especially in the current situation where you have suicide bombings in Israel and you have attacks by Israel against cities and refugee camps in the West Bank and Gaza, this must have strained your relationship with Palestinians somewhat. Has it?
Right. It's been very hard. It's been very hard, partly because of the polarization. And there are more and more Palestinians that obviously don't want to work with Israelis anymore. And it's also hard logistically. We can't meet. Palestinians can't come into Israel. We can't go into Palestinian areas because the army prevents us. And it becomes very hard to work together. But the fact that we're persevering and we're resisting together, you know, now in the last few weeks, we've been very involved in picking olives, helping Palestinians pick olives. They're all impoverished. There's been a closure now for since 1992 on the entire West Bank and Gaza. Palestinians have been locked out of the Israeli job market. Their own infrastructure and economy has been absolutely destroyed. They have nothing except their agriculture. And they can't go out and pick the olives and grapes in their own fields because the settlers and the armies come in to stop them. So the people are actually starving. You know, and according to a Johns Hopkins report, 30% of Palestinian kids suffer from malnutrition. So here's a situation of tremendous oppression. So we go out with the Palestinians to protect them and help them harvest their own olives so that they're not shot and beaten by either the settlers or the army. That's how bad things are. And so our house demolition actions have gone into other areas as well, like helping to pick olives, for example. And that's given us a lot of credibility with the Palestinians.
Because you're willing to put your...
In their time of need, we've been there for them.
And you're willing to put your bodies on the line?
That's right.
Right, because...
And even today, just today, I wasn't out there, but there were a number of peace people that were beaten up viciously by the settlers with rifle butts. You can read it probably in the newspaper tomorrow in Santa Cruz.
Israelis? Israeli
peace people were out with Palestinians picking olives and were attacked by settlers and beaten viciously with rifle butts and fists and all kinds of things.
Why would settlers do that? Why would they beat Israelis helping Palestinians pick olives?
Because the settlers are trying to chase the Arabs off the land completely. The settlers are the shock troops of the claim that this is our country exclusively, and we don't want Arabs here. And there's whole Palestinian villages, for example, the village of Yanun, up near Nablus, that have been completely abandoned because they've been attacked so fiercely by settlers, and the army does nothing to protect the Palestinians, which is against international law, because in international law, Israel has a responsibility to protect the Palestinians.
Because they're the occupying force.
That's right.
Because under international law, the occupying force has to protect the civilians, the people.
Exactly. Because they have no other source of protection. They don't have their own state, or their own police, or their own army. But Israel doesn't do that. And so they give the settlers a free hand to beat Palestinians. As long as it's Palestinians, it's no big deal for Israelis. But now they're beating Israelis, our own people to go out there, so that the whole thing is becoming extremely vicious. But the fact that we're there with the Palestinians, we get beaten together with them, we risk our lives with them, and we recognize that they have a right to this country as well, is something that allows us to keep this flame of reconciliation alive.
Jeff,
it's a terrible situation.
Tell me, how many houses has the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions rebuilt after they were demolished by the Israeli government since you started 6 or 7 years ago. How many houses have you managed to rebuild together with Palestinians?
Right. We've rebuilt about 14 houses, some of them that have been demolished 2 or 3 times. Even the one of Salim Shawamri, who I was traveling with, was demolished 3 times, and now we're building it for the 4th time. I want to emphasize that these are political acts of resistance. It's not humanitarian work. The Red Cross, when it goes out, or CARE, can build more houses. But we build houses with families that are willing to resist the occupation, and not every family is willing to do that. For Palestinian families, that means risking being beaten or killed. It means getting the house demolished again. It means going through the trauma again. It means financial loss, risking arrest. So Palestinians are very scared and intimidated. So there aren't a lot of people that are willing to work with us to resist an army. It's a pretty brave thing to do. And therefore, the 14 houses we've rebuilt aren't a critical mass in terms of numbers, but they're very important in terms of making the point that we're not going to let the occupation win. And, of course, the other message in building together is that we refuse to be enemies, that we are not enemies, and you're not going to make us enemies. We're going to struggle together until a just peace can emerge.
Now, what is a just peace? Not too long ago, and this will be my final question, you made the statement that you didn't feel that because of the facts on the ground, which you say are the settlements, the roads, the cities, the military outposts in the West Bank and Gaza, that there even is a possibility we may have passed the point where it's even viable for a Palestinian state to exist because of these facts on the ground. It almost sounds like you're saying it's not possible for a Palestinian state to emerge. Is that what you're saying? And
no.
If so, what's the solution? What is a peace?
Well,
what
is
a just, peaceful solution?
What I'm saying is that I don't think negotiations can work anymore. We're in a situation like with South Africa with apartheid, in which it's either end the occupation or it'll continue forever. There's no more compromise possible. You know, when de Klerk went to Mandela and said, you know, we'll give the black African population a chamber of its own in parliament, Mandela said no. There's no compromise. Apartheid is over or else I'm staying in prison forever. It got to that stage where there was no point to negotiate anymore. And we're at that point. And it has to be, I think, the only solution is to end the occupation. And the only way to end the occupation is if we mount an international campaign, if everybody in the world takes on this issue the same way they took on the issue of apartheid in South Africa. You know, apartheid became an issue of concern to people all over the world, way beyond the local South African situation. And that's the same thing here. This has to become a universal international issue. And then I think, with international pressure, we have to force Israel to end the occupation completely. Not 90%, not 95%, 100% end the occupation and allow a Palestinian state to emerge, which is not something that will harm Israel in any way whatsoever, to give up the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza.
How can
Israel still keep 78% of the country?
Mm-hmm.
And then, like I said before, the next stage, I think, will be a regional confederation. But there has to be an absolute end to the occupation, and that can only happen through international pressure for a just peace to emerge.
How can there be that international pressure? And I guess in asking that, I'm saying, how can people here help that to happen?
Well, they can help it. It's happening, you know. In the University of Michigan, a couple of weeks ago, there was a big divestment campaign. Turns out the University of Michigan itself has about $600 million invested in Israeli defense and other kinds of industries. I wonder how many hundreds of millions the University of California system has invested in Israel. I wonder what kind of defense contracts go back and forth between Israel and just the University of California, or the state of California, which is heavily dependent on the arms industry. A divestment campaign in California from Israeli, only from Israeli defense industries would have a tremendous impact. We have to find ways of putting pressures through sanctions, divestment, moral pressures, and especially pressures on Congress. Because Congress is Israel's trump card. As long as Congress, and here you got Boxer and Feinstein, who are two of the worst senators from the point of view of this blind support for Sharon and Israel, and not being helpful whatsoever in terms of creating a just peace here, you've got to bring these people into line and say, no, you can't be liberals on all these other issues, and when it comes to Israel, allow an apartheid situation to emerge. And only if we work with Congress, we work economically, we work internationally, and cooperate with groups like ours. There's us, there's Gush Shalom, there's Payush, there's a lot of Israeli groups that you can cooperate with. Bat Shalom, which is the Israeli Women's Peace Organization, the Women's Coalition for Peace, there's a lot of groups. Work with us in order to end this occupation.
Rabbis for Human Rights is another one.
There are quite a few groups, actually.
Right, Yeshkavul being the movement of soldiers who are refusing to serve in the occupied territories, right?
That's right.
And Ta'ush, is that Palestinians and Israelis working together, correct?
Palestinian and Jewish citizens of Israel. Mm. A lot of them are students, Ta'ush, that work together, do very good things on the ground to fight the occupation. In other words, this isn't something that's anti-Israel. It's linking up with progressive Israeli forces that say it's in Israel's interest to end the occupation. That's part of the win-win scenario that I was talking about. So if you really want to help Israel, help it get out of the occupation, help it get out of this mess, instead of helping it to create an apartheid situation that in the end is really going to be a danger to Israel's existence, I think.
Jeff Halper, how can people contact the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and help you in your work to rebuild Palestinian homes as a political statement and move against the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza?
Well, you can join our campaign. We have a campaign that we call the Right to a Home and a Homeland, where we're trying to raise funds to build 20 to 30 houses throughout the occupied territories. And you can access it from our website, which is www.icahd.org. www.icahd.org. And that's our website, and there you'll see the Rebuilding Homes campaign and some of the other things that we're doing. And we invite everybody to get involved and even to come and help us build.
Any final thoughts today, Jeff?
Well, no, but I think where we ended was very important. In other words, the idea that without the help of all of you, without the help of the international civil society, NGOs, church groups, faith-based groups, trade unions, students, universities, political groups, and so on, we're not alone going to be able to end this occupation and to avoid apartheid. So we need your help. And again, you have some of our addresses to get in touch with us and try to help us.
Thank you so much for your time today, Jeff.
Okay, thanks a lot, George, for having me.
All right. Bye.
Bye.